The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
On this day, 100 years ago, the Irish Civil War began and continued for almost a year. In the first couple of months of the conflict, four key figures in the fight for Irish freedom from British rule were dead. Most famously, on the 22nd of August, Michael Collins was shot at Béal na Bláth. 10 days earlier, his pro-treaty colleague Arthur Griffith died, having collapsed on the street from a brain hemorrhage. 10 days before that, Harry Boland, formerly a great friend of Michael Collins, died from his wounds, having been confronted in the Grand Hotel in Skerries by Free State forces. Just 3 weeks before that, another anti-treaty figure, Cathal Brua, died from his wounds, having refused to surrender to Free State forces at the Granville Hotel in O'Connell Street in Dublin. He emerged, a pistol in each hand, inviting the inevitable shot. Now, he was shot in the leg, severing the femoral artery, and he bled out. Was it a deliberate act of martyrdom? Perhaps we shall never know. The reality of that Civil War enmity was brought home in these losses. And my next guest believes that one of the four has been a bit neglected in the narrative, and that man is Cathal Brua. So he and his colleague Gerald Hanley have attempted to rectify that in a new book entitled Cathal Brua, An Indomitable Spirit. Lecturer in History at the School of History and Geography at DCU, Dr. Dahi O'Corain, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hello, Pat. It is a pleasure to join you and your listeners this morning.
Now, let's talk about Cathal Brua. Like, where was he from? Who was he? What did he do before politics?
He was born in Drumcondra, Pat, and like many of his generation, he was drawn into the Gaelic League. He was very involved in the Gaelic League. From that, he progressed to the Irish Volunteers, very active member of the IRB, and a very prominent figure during the 1916 Rising, a very heroic defiance in the South Dublin Union. And that, in a sense, launches him as a key figure during the Irish Revolution.
Tell me about his personal life, because he was married to a woman, and older Dubliners will be familiar with her surname.
They will, Pat. He was married to Kathleen Kingston, and after Cathal's death, Kathleen established a well-known men's outfitters. I believe you remember it yourself.
Kingston's, called Kingston's, O'Connell Street.
Correct. Known for its fine shirts and men's attire. Now, that was very much, she was originally from Birr in County Offaly. It was a meeting of hearts, Pat, but it was also a meeting of minds. She was as much an ardent Republican as her husband. We use the term indomitable to describe Brua, but it is equally applicable to Kathleen. And over the last 20 years, some of the most exciting historical research has revealed the important and various roles that women played in the Irish Revolution. And Gerard Hanley and I were very anxious to try and bring to the fore Kathleen's involvement in her husband's career.
Do you know how they met?
They met at a Gaelic League class. Again, that was relatively common. De Valera also met his...
Sinead Van De Valera.
Exactly. They met at a Gaelic League class in Birr. And then she subsequently moved to Rathmines. Her brother was a priest in nearby St. Mary's. And the family lived in Rathmines after they were married.
Her own family, the Kingstons of Birr, were they in business?
They were in business on the main street. They were very well known in local politics. Her brother Charles was involved in the county council. Some members of her family joined religious life. But when after her father died, she and her mother and her sister moved to Rathmines. And when she got married in 1912, that became the Brua family home.
Now, Cathal Brua himself, obviously a heroic figure in the 1916 Rising, and then we get to the post-Rising situation and we have the first Dáil, and he was honoured.
He was honoured, Pat. He was the first speaker or Ceann Comhairle. But in addition to that, he also served as the first president pro tempore while De Valera was in Lincoln Prison. And those two honours signify Brua's importance in this period. He really plays a pivotal role, as we argue in our book, in resurrecting the Irish Volunteers and in welding the disparate elements of Sinn Féin together ahead of the 1918 general election.
Now, we then move on to the War of Independence and how that ultimately was successful, but leading up, of course, to treaty and negotiations. And that's where he and his good friend, Michael Collins, parted company politically, although it could be said from the heart they never really were at odds.
It's a complicated question, Pat. I'm glad you mentioned that they were close, because they certainly were before 1920. But the relationship soured for three main reasons. So first of all, in personality terms, they're polar opposites. Ernie O'Malley described how Brua didn't drink or curse or smoke, and Collins excelled at all of those vices. Collins also had a tendency to stick his oar into the business of his cabinet colleagues, but resisted any scrutiny of his own. And Brua was a stickler for financial accountability.
What was his background, by the way, professionally? I mean, was he a teacher or...
He was in business. He originally worked for a British candle and church making goods company, and then he established his own company called Lawler's.
Okay, so he would have been interested in the pounds, shillings and pence of things and kept an eye on detail.
He would, and also his own formative experience when he was a boy. The family went bankrupt, so he has this mania, if you like, about financial accountability. But the main reason, Pat, that Brua and Collins fall out is that Brua is a vehement critic of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, the source of Collins's influence, because he feels it undermines him as Minister for Defence, and that it undermines the independence of the Dáil, including the vote on the treaty.
Now, he made a speech in Dáil Éireann which was described as venomous about Collins.
It was vitriolic, Pat, and it really it was those festering tensions that I mentioned. In a sense, they come to a head and they explode in this extraordinary personal attack, not just on Collins, but also on Griffith. It does a great deal of damage to Brua's reputation and legacy, and it did very little to swing the Dáil around to Brua's position on the treaty.
Now, talk to us about the treaty negotiations themselves. I mean, you had a situation where De Valera stayed as, if you like, the ace in the hole, you know, the kind of person that you go to as a last resort. But he never went to London. He stayed put, and Griffith and Collins and the rest of the delegation went over. And the argument has been there forever where they hung out to dry.
I suppose once negotiations begin, it is inevitable that compromise of some kind will have to be entertained. Brua becomes increasingly worried during the treaty negotiations that his precious republic, the governing thesis of his life, that will no longer be pursued.
I mean, what was on offer was dominion status.
And of course, that's not enough for De Valera and for Brua. And for them, after the treaty, the choice facing the Irish people is one of whether they want to remain British subjects in a dominion or citizens of an Irish Republic. And they want the Irish public to decide that at the 1922 general election.
Which they do.
Which they do, Pat, absolutely. Decisively in favour of the treaty position.
Now, you know, the fact that total war was threatened, and we talked on the programme recently about the death of Wilson, the assassination in London, and how that played into what happened next, which was the civil war, the occupation of the forecourts by the anti-treaty forces, but then this assassination, which really angered the British government.
And it forces Michael Collins to take action. Now, for Brua, he is a most reluctant participant in the Civil War. We write in the book of how he fights and dies in a war that he tries to prevent. But the use of borrowed British artillery is a sort of a tipping point for Brua. And on the 29th of June, he re-enlists, along with De Valera, Barton and Stack as a private in the IRA in O'Connell Street.
All right, so now we have this the standoff, which becomes a war once the forecourts are shelled. And then very quickly, and I mentioned at the beginning there, in the space of just 2 months, four key figures are dead. Now, one was Arthur Griffith, who died of a brain hemorrhage. The others, though, they died violent deaths.
They did. And I think Brua had almost made up his mind. He sought spiritual advice before he went to O'Connell Street. He had made up his mind that he was not going to surrender. And there's some wonderful eyewitness accounts from the Hammam Hotel, which describe Brua as reaching a sort of inner peace in defence of the Republic. And when he was asked by Linda Cairns, why he was willing to sacrifice his life. He responded that civil war was so awful that his death would be worthwhile if it brought that conflict to an end.
And of course it didn't, as we know. It took, until, was it June the following year or May?
May the following year, it finished.
So here we have Karl Brewer and his colleagues, and he orders the others to surrender. They're surrounded by Free State troops.
They're surrounded. And the whole idea was that they would hold out for as long as possible with minimum loss of life. Now, most of the garrison were evacuated on the 3rd of July. So De Valera and most of the future Fianna Fáil front bench are evacuated. And Brua is left in charge of a small garrison of 17 men and 3 women. So he is very concerned for their welfare. They surrender. He doesn't. He emerges brandishing 2 pistols, not firing, Pat, as some accounts suggest, but he refuses to halt, and then he's shot and his femoral artery is severed.
And he bleeds out, basically.
He's removed to the Mater Hospital, where he dies 2 days later on the 7th.
They could not save him. They tried.
And I suppose it's important for us to remember that Brua suffered 25 wounds after the 1916 rising. He was in constant pain throughout the remainder of his life. So he didn't have a good basis, if you like, from which to sustain such a serious wound.
So it would appear that he was determined that his life would be given to try and stop the civil war. That's your thesis. In the modern parlance, this would be death by cop.
It would. Brewer was also very influenced, Pat, by Éamon Cant, his great friend from the 1916 Rising. And in Cant's last letter to us, the Irish people, he wrote that if he had his time back again, he would not have surrendered. And Brewer, in a sense, is true to that sentiment expressed by Cant.
Yeah, that line that he didn't want to die. He was prepared to die by an orange bullet, by a British bullet, but he did not want to die by a bullet fired by one of his comrades.
Absolutely. The civil war, the prospect of fratricidal strife was a nightmare scenario for Brua. And he did everything he could, Pat, to try and prevent that in the months before the beginning of the civil war.
Now, the civil war has started when he dies, and what was the funeral like? And his former friends and colleagues, did they participate? Did they offer any words of condolence?
The funeral is very interesting, Pat. It is used by Kathleen Brewer as a means to protest against the government and the civil war. So government ministers are not allowed to attend. Cumann na mBan are the sole individuals allowed to form a guard of honour. The likes of Harry Boland, even though he had his differences with Brewer, he attends the funeral. De Valera does not. Famously, when Boland himself was wounded, he wrote of how he wanted to be in the same grave as Cathal Brua, an indication of the esteem in which Brua was held by.
But Harry Boland and Cathal Brua were on the same side. They were anti-treaty. Why did Dev not show up at the funeral?
I think Dev was spirited away to Cork. He was probably...
They fearful for his safety?
I think so.
Would he be a target?
I think so. Maybe not a target, but certainly a target of arrest.
All right. And did Collins make any reference to Brua's death?
Oh, he did. There were tributes, Pat, from all sides. Ironically, Collins claimed that when everybody else was forgotten, Cathal Brua's contribution would be remembered. That's not the way, of course, it transpired. But there is a respect between them. And in a movement of zealots, Brua, if you like, is the king zealot. And that's recognised and I think admired by the likes of Collins.
Now, after his death, how did his widow and children cope?
I suppose Kathleen threw herself into working for the Republican side as a speaker and a fundraiser. She then succeeded her husband as a TD for Waterford, and she represented Waterford as an anti-treaty and later Sinn Féin TD until the September 1927 general election, when Sinn Féin no longer contested due to lack of funds. Her main priority, Pat, was to safeguard the well-being of her 6 children. The youngest, Nessa, was just 3 months old when her father died. Brua was very young when he died. He was just shy of his 48th birthday. And she threw her energies into her new business venture that we mentioned at the earlier, Kingston's.
Now, for our younger listeners, I suppose you might remind them of how the Civil War ended. I mean, it was less than a year long, but of course the ramifications are still with us today.
I suppose it was the writing was on the wall from early 1923 that the government side was going to be successful. It changed the trajectory of Irish politics, which was centred around where you stood on the Civil War, as opposed to left-right issues, which would be more typical in European countries.
Because Labour had done well in...
it had.
Yeah.
And of course, we see then the emergence of Fine Gael on one side and Fianna Fáil on the other, the losers of the Civil War, ironically, becoming one of the most successful political parties in 20th century Europe.
And that kind of 180 turn that De Valera and his colleagues managed, how do they achieve that? Having fought a civil war, looking for a republic, accepting a free state, and it was then not even a Fianna Fáil government that changed the status to a republic.
I suppose for De Valera, he's given very good advice about the oath and how he can get around the oath. And then it became an existential crisis for him in the sense that he either participates in politics or he becomes an irrelevance. And that's why he breaks with Sinn Féin and establishes Fianna Fáil in 1926.
The great survivor.
Absolutely.
Well, the book is terrific. It's published by Four Courts Press. It's called Cathal Brua, An Indomitable Spirit. It's written by my guest, Dr. Dahi O'Corrine, along with his colleague, Gerald Hanley. And thank you very much for joining us in studio today.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.